You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Imagine growing up in the east of London in the 1970s. And having experiences that no one can help you with. A child trying to come to terms with strange visitors, odd encounters, and even abductions. My guest today is Michael Cameron, and we discuss some of these events from his childhood that he's covered in his first book, High Strangeness, A Lifetime of Alien and Paranormal Encounters. Michael will take us through some of the events that marked his childhood, and I'm sure you'll find them deeply compelling. But as always, before we join Michael, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes to sign up too. We'll also be launching on Apple Premium in the next couple of weeks, so if you prefer to sign up via that method, once it's live, I'll have the link in the show notes for you as well. Thank you to each and every one of my patrons for your continued support. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube as we rapidly approach 2,500 subscribers. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network, and a massive thank you to the incredible Weary Pines for my new intro and outro music, and you can find a link to their site in the show notes as well. How does a child deal with these invasive events alone? Michael's story will attempt to explain how he tried. Today, I'm joined by author and experiencer, Michael Cameron. His book, High Strangeness, A Lifetime of Alien and Paranormal Encounters, covers a range of encounters and experiences that punctuated his life throughout this period. Michael, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Hello, Paul.
When I read books of this nature, Michael, the thing that often strikes me, not the contents about the experiences or anything, is often for people like yourself, I find these are very personal and raw experiences because, yes, there's a lot of high strangeness that works throughout the book, but there's also a real insight into what it was like as a young person growing up in that period of the 70s and 80s that I'm not too far behind you in vintage, shall we say, Michael. So I'm aware of many of the touch points that you refer to throughout the book.
Sure.
Of social and cultural incidents that occur throughout that period. I would suspect, Michael, that perhaps reading the book and looking back on it as an adult these days, was it difficult to try and unpick the issues and situations of the family, regardless of everything else that we're going to talk about that was working, that was sort of weaved in between all these relationships and stresses that you had at that point of your life?
I guess so. It was quite difficult for me growing up in the family that I did. I grew up in as I said in the book, a strict Roman Catholic family and a strict Roman Catholic environment. So it was hard to deal with at the time.
I think it is surprising for some people. Obviously, I've got a lot of friends from London, Michael. Yeah. I know London very well. I wouldn't say I know it like the back of my hand, because every time I go back, something's changed. But, yeah. as is the way of London.
Yeah.
Obviously, one of my best friends has married into a Irish family from your particular neck of the woods as well, so I'm very aware. And I think sometimes, for a lot of people outside of the Roman Catholic faith, would be very surprised that even into the modern era, there were very strict guidelines. I know that you mention it in your book. You would have to say prayers before you went to bed, and you obviously had to do a lot of things. You mentioned a bit at Christmas where you were very annoyed at having to be dressed up once again as a kind of mini beef eater to perform for people at the Christmas functions. And I think it's surprising that a lot of people, unless they know anybody of that particular faith or they have friends in it, it seems like something completely different to them. So I suppose that all adds to this feeling of loneliness and isolation for you as a young person growing up, having these experiences and not really having the social settings to support you through it, even though, as we read in the book, there are some sort of points that make you wonder just how open-minded your parents actually were.
Yeah, you know, there was when myself, you know, and Sean, who's like, he's 2 years older than me, and brother, when we were having some of these experiences, not all together, there was, you know, there were times when we were having them and we spoke about them to our parents, they did seem to be, you know, their reactions were a little bit odd in that, you know, you'd think they would either, you know, be skeptical but they didn't seem to be like that. They seemed to, in a way, acknowledge, they didn't actually acknowledge, but there was a part of them that would suggest that they'd had experiences like this themselves or had, you know, had seen certain things themselves, but maybe wasn't talking about them. I mean, back in them days, families were secretive.
Absolutely. And I think as well, it's one of those things because there are a lot of issues that would be suppressed or pushed to the side in those days that in the modern era, thankfully, a lot of people are more open about talking about a lot of traumatic experiences, regardless of talking about the world of high strangeness, Michael, that 30, 40 years ago, you just couldn't talk about, because rather than perpetrators being exposed, it would often come back to you or the person that was reporting particular incidents. It's something I remember as a child growing up, Michael, that it seemed to be quite a dangerous place. I know often this day and age, people are always warning of the dangers of arranging to meet people or whatever. But I think for people who grew up in that era, I often look back and think, you know, it was a bloody dangerous time to be a young person, especially as a lot of us would just walk about on our own or with groups of friends. We were prey for some people out there on the streets, Michael, and yet we were never sort of given the tools to deal with those situations or be aware of it. And it's quite shocking to look back when I read your book and a couple of the incidents in there. It reminds me of some incidents that occurred around me in the peripheral of my friends as a child growing up. Very similar things, and people would just shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, yeah, everybody knows what he's like. What?
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
It's tough reading, Michael, in certain parts, but I don't mean that in the content of the book or how it's written. And it's the subject matter that makes me sometimes shake my head and deeply sympathise with yourself and some of the scenarios that you found yourself in. I mean, there is a part in the book where you'd had that awful Christmas. And you just, it's just one line, and you just said you spent it just wishing you were dead, which I think is an awful thing to think about. And the rawness and honesty about how you must have been feeling throughout this. Fair play to you to being able to open it up and put it down there, Michael, because I think it would be a poor show of me to not commend you for your bravery in this book. Regardless of everything else, I think there are aspects of this book that are powerful and emotional that are not dealing with high strangeness. So I applaud your bravery.
The reason I wrote those things in, though, is that, you know, going forward in my second book, I'll explain more about that, is, you know, that some of the experiences that I did have that would be quite sensitive.
Yes.
I believe they are connected in some ways to some of the instances I would have later on in my life.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to, you know, things like MK Ultra and stuff like that, subjects like this. And, you know, a lot of the time it is to do with control the person. It's to do with isolating the person. So you can be used in various ways.
Mm, absolutely. Make you malleable.
Exactly. Yeah. You're basically, you know, a lot of the time with control, it's to do with, especially, you know, with abductions as well, and the greys are very much insidious in their activities. Obviously they, you know, they rely on being hidden, you know. A lot of the time a lot of abductions take place at night time and at various hours in the morning, you know, when normally the world is sleeping. But a lot of the time as well, if you have anyone around you, like any predator, they seem to try to separate you from other people to get you alone, so that then they can have full control over you. And also another thing is that when when people have, and still do, you know, even now it's more open, ridicule people, that allows them to have a greater control,
because
it allows them then to do what they need to do in the under the, you know, the inner security that they all know that you're going to be laughed at and not believed. And that is as a child, that's even harder to deal with, because it's then, you know, it's almost like you're being abused again.
Yes, because I think when you're brought up to try and be honest, as we are, and if we're not, we'd get in those days a thick ear.
That's right.
Oh, in your case, you'd get brained, as your father was apt to say to you boys, keeping them on their toes. It's the worst thing that can happen to a child, especially if you're constantly told you can't lie. Never lie. Tell the truth. And when you do tell the truth, people don't believe you.
That's right. You know, it's in the same ways that, you know, as I say in my book, you know, they tell you that there's no monsters under the, you know, yes, under the bed. But, you know, what if there is? You know, what if there are monsters under the bed? And we're often, you know, children are often told. I'm not saying obviously everything is, you know, related to this type of phenomena, because of course it's not. But you know, when it is, and then you're told it's all in your head or you fantasize, when in actual fact it's not that case, you know, and it's so difficult. How do you explain it to somebody and get them to believe you?
Precisely. I mean, was this something that you've been wanting to do for quite a while, Michael, that you wanted to kind of catalogue these things? Because obviously there is a theme throughout the book whenever you're having these experiences of almost trying to force yourself to remember particular incidents, as though you need to remember it. You can't forget what's happened, you have to remember it. And so when you've come to this point of your life where you're now looking backwards at this strange and mysterious life that you've had, and these odd and peculiar encounters of a variety of entities, I suppose that attitude that you had as a child in trying to sort of burn these incidents into your memory has stood you in good stead, because it's allowed you to look back perhaps with a bit more clarity than some people would have had.
I mean, I've always, you know, I've always had a marker memory. I think a lot of abductees do have marker memories almost burnt into their memory. And as for the book, I've always wanted to write a book. I always knew at some point I would. I just didn't know when. And I've always been someone who's a writer, you know. I've always written stuff, more or less subjects regards to, you know, high strangeness, or any time I have any experiences, I obviously put them down in the journal. But, you know, when I was writing the book, it took me about 5 drafts, really, to do the book. It's normally a lot less than that, I believe. But, you know, I wanted to get it right. So I didn't actually know how it would come together. And this is why in the beginning, I've always said that at first I was going to make a bigger book. But then I think around the fourth draft I did, I decided then to make them into volumes, because that way it's a smaller book, but it's you know, it's very detailed. But then I wanted the person reading the book to get an idea of who I am and what I'm about, and to follow the narrative into a second volume. And it's so in that second volume, it'll be in a different location at a different age. But what I didn't know at the time, as a child and a teenager, is that this type of phenomena would follow me around. I don't think about it's going to be just in this house, you know, my childhood home, where you would have it. I didn't expect it then to follow me as a young man, and then follow me wherever I went. It's just a continuation, really.
Yeah.
But it's taken a long time to write the book, because you know, when I thought I was ready, I wasn't. And I still find it difficult sometimes to tell people what the book's about.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the hidden trauma.
Yeah.
You know, somebody the other day was saying to me, "Oh, Michael, you've wrote a book, haven't you?" And I went, "Yes." And they were saying, "What's it called?" And I said, you know, "High Strangeness." And then I it's the alien part I couldn't say.
Yes.
And I just like saying, "Oh, you know, it's by, you know, Michael Cameron." You know, they didn't know my second name. With a K, and you know, and I said it's about paranormal encounters.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, you're going to obviously see what it is, but I couldn't say it.
Yeah.
And it's really, really hard to sometimes say that, what it's about.
I suppose as well, where you are now in your life, you probably, nobody knew you growing up, Michael. You've moved out of London.
Yeah.
You've moved into the wilds of the Southwest. Cider country. So I would imagine as well, one of the biggest aspects is when you're bringing a book out like this, all these people around you, I would suspect that the majority of them didn't know anything about this part of your life. They just knew you as Michael.
Well, somebody has bought my book now. She doesn't know me well, but she knows me. But she didn't know nothing about that side of me, but she wanted to read the book. But, you know, but it's only yesterday that I found out that she stopped reading it at night. And you know, and she doesn't really, I don't think she knows really what to say to me.
Well, I mean, that is often the thing. I know, you know, as we mentioned Paul earlier, when Paul released Night People.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm no expert at this, Michael. I'm not going to pretend I'm some kind of sociologist.
I don't think any of us are.
Well, yeah, thankfully. And but I could tell by the content of the book that regardless of his standing in the field, there were people that were going to view this book as negative because of what he was saying, regardless of Paul's work previously. And it always happens when anybody talks about these particular fields and the people I've spoken to in the past that have had strange experiences, strange encounters. I think the biggest issue is for a lot of people, as you've referred to about trauma and PTSD and the things that have happened to a lot of people who have had weird things happen to them, is you've no sounding board at all. There is nobody. I know you've mentioned it to your parents when you were growing up and your brothers and such, but I think it's difficult because that's all it is, and it's a case of just bottling it up in such a manner that's not healthy for people, because you're constantly thinking, is it me? Is it me? Is it me? Am I going mad? Am I going crazy? What's wrong with me? Why does this happen to me?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I've gone through all those emotions, and, you know, when you're a child, you don't really think about the what's happening to you. You know, I kind of thought at the time, you know, it was normal and other people had it because I didn't have much contact with people. And because I suppose the way my parents reacted, it just seemed normal. Like, you know, okay, maybe everyone else is having it, but I'm just not saying it to anyone. But even as a teenager, it wasn't until I would say probably in the 1990s that I started to really try to understand what it was, that there was obviously, you know, that there was something wrong. You know, when I was a teenager, I was, you know, you come to that conclusion, you know, that this is not normal as in normal in the normal what we're used to, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, but you're most definitely, and I wouldn't just say this, you know, about abductees, you know, for anyone who's experienced the paranormal or even, you know, seeing Bigfoot or the Dogman and that, and they have not seen this before, you know, you're living two lives, really. You live in this one that everyone knows you, you know.
Yep.
And then you're living this secret one. And although people within these, you know, within the communities that we're familiar with, obviously they know that we have them and we know that they have them. But people outside of that, even family, you know, they might not even know you're having these experiences. Unless you are open about it. But from what I know now, a lot of people are not.
Yeah.
Not around other people. And, you know, someone's asking me, you know, should you tell people about it? Well, if you're with somebody that you don't really know, I think the best advice for that is to put something out there, something small, and see how they react to it.
Yeah.
And then if they react to it, you know, in a way, maybe a condescending way or disbelief or being skeptical, then, you know, you don't need to say anything more.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, you're putting something small out rather than a bigger aspect of what you're having. So you're not left open for ridicule or anything.
Yeah, I think it made me smile as well when I started reading the book and obviously some of the early experiences you had, because there's a parallel with my early childhood. Apparently I used to have somebody come and sit on my bed, but it was an old gentleman, Michael, and I used to have many a conversation with this chap who would tell me all about the world and the war. I've no idea who this chap was.
Sure.
And I don't really remember the conversation, sadly. But my mum said for the best part of 2 or 3 years, I would always have conversations 2 or 3 times a week with this gentleman who I always said was a lovely old man. And so when I read other people's experiences of having visitors in their rooms when they're children, I think what often strikes me is that kids don't bat an eyelid, Michael,
no,
about visitors, regardless of whether they are ghosts or people or creatures. If there's a friendly rapport there, it seems that children are very matter of fact. They take these on face value. They say, oh yeah, this is great, I've got my own special friends and they come and see me. And so when I was reading the section when you were having one of your conversations and you could hear your mum sneaking up to the door.
Yeah,
earwig. And opening the door, you turn away from your friends to tell you, and as your mum stands in the doorway, you say, oh, who are you talking to, Michael? Oh, my friends. And they've gone.
Yeah.
And yet, your mum, once again, as you've said, seemed to be quite apt with this. It seems to be this thing, as we've said earlier, about some of the normal issues that you've encountered over your life, that you, when you talk to people and try and unburden yourself and be honest about it, and people don't believe you. It's remarkable how many families, parents, have these stories about their kids having imaginary friends, as they would call them, Michael. Because to the child, they are not imaginary at all. They are flesh and blood, real, whatever. They are there. They are people. They have a relationship with them. So for you, I was very interested in the fact that you seem to have like a rotating group of people that would come. I know you mentioned a couple, and sometimes you would say that the man would come and then there would be different men, but they were all of a similar look. And I suppose most people would say the description matches what's become known as the Nordics.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, obviously back then I didn't know what that meant.
Yes.
I just, like you were saying, you know, you just know that they're there and you're talking to them and they're interacting with you, but you don't really think that there's anything really wrong with that at the time. And obviously the ones that I did have communications with, they were, I guess, then what would be considered now through classical, you know, ufology, the humanoid Nordic type. But I didn't know back then what they were.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is the thing as well, and we'll touch on this later on, the period that this begins in your life, there is no sort of catalyst or the usual explanation that popular culture is bleeding into your psyche, Michael. You know, this is the early 70s.
That's
British
right,
television was not full of documentaries about UFOs. Of that, we can be aware.
No, it was like Crossroads and stuff like that. You know.
Well, to be fair, some people might think that show was created by aliens, looking at the way some people thought acting was in those days, Michael. It's a very strange program at the best of times.
But it's a bit like Benny.
Benny and his hat, and Miss Diane.
Yeah, that's it.
But for you then, this aspect of it, this sort of germination of the beginning of all this, these characters seemed quite friendly, quite nice to you. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any sort of negativity to them. I mean, it's difficult, I suppose, to try and look past how they were. And I know you kind of theorize in the book, were they setting you up? Were they testing you? Was this the first contact before they kind of changed?
Yeah, that's right.
Do you look back on that particular part of your life experiences as a positive thing, that they weren't as obtrusive and as difficult to deal with as some of the later encounters you have with others?
Well, you know what, I'm in two schools of thought over that still. I don't know, you know, because as I was explaining in the book, you know, I was often running away in sometimes terror from them when they, you know, when they'd vanished, when there was time missing, and you know what happened in between that time, what I lost.
Yeah.
And you know, I've often wondered if were they friendly or were they foe, you know, friend or foe, so to speak. But because one part of me thinks, okay, they were okay, and these were ones that I had contact with, and then I had the, you know, what we could now know as the Greys, and maybe they pushed them to the side, or was it possible that they were working together? So I had the friendlier ones first, preparing the way for what was to come, which would have been them.
Yeah.
If I was to say, Paul, to you that I know, I would be lying. I don't know. I'm just trying to understand this. What I'm trying to understand in my own mind, what it could be. It's one or the other, or it might mean even it might be none of them.
Yeah,
I just don't really know. But I think whenever you have any of these type of experiences, you know, as a human being, you're trying to understand. But yes. I can't say to you I have the answers. I don't.
Well, that's a good thing to be, because I find anybody that says they've got all the answers usually hasn't, Michael. And I think the modern age more people are being honest enough to hold their hands up and go, I don't know. And there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know. We can all surmise or theorize what we think's going on or what our interpretation of an event is, because even if we look at those and, like you say, how it changes over the years, for all we know, that could have been the same group of people, but those first encounters may have been some kind of screen memory that was supplanted into your head to make you feel more welcome and open to them.
They could be, but the only problem with that, though, is that you remember the greys take images from your head. I didn't have those images in my head at the time.
Yeah.
Because of the time I grew up. Mm. And also because I grew up in a, you know, again, in a close-knit Irish family, you know, there was nothing in them times. There was nothing around. We didn't watch the TV unless we were with the parents. And, you know, we were, as I said in the book, we were the people, me and Sean changed the channels over because we, you know, we didn't have the, and I think a lot of kids from them times did.
Yeah.
we get a clout around the head.
Yeah. We were the remote control, Michael.
Exactly. We were, you know, until the time, you know, we had a remote control, yeah. but we didn't have anything. You know, when people say, like you said earlier, Paul, you know, about if someone could say, oh, you were influenced by this, that and the other. Well, I wasn't, and neither was Sean, because we just didn't have that. We didn't have anything that we could associate with that with.
Yeah.
So it's possible it could have been the screen memory. But as for the Nordics, though, we didn't have any reference to that.
Precise.
We just didn't. You know, we're a lot of the time in the, you know, I was in a strict Roman Catholic environment. I went to a school, the schoolhouse and the school were Catholic. Mm. The school was, my childhood home belonged to the Roman Catholic Church. Mm. So, and, you know, if we weren't at home doing, I guess, chores and stuff like that, we were in the church.
Yeah.
Doing whatever, you know, singing or saying prayers or going to mass. Mm. Or being taught in the school by the, but you know, because we had nuns and we had a convent up the road and we had a presbytery with priests.
Yeah.
So and that kind of environment is what we were used to. Mm. So it was a little bit of a shock.
Yes, I can imagine it was. And to be fair, if you were that easily manipulated and as I'm sure people and I know you do, some people stipulated that you were losing control of your mind and you were going mad, Michael. If you had, the only kind of cultural absorption you would be getting would be from the Roman Catholic Church. One would suspect if you were hallucinating or imagining these things, why weren't you seeing angels then rather than other people?
That's a very good point. Yeah, that's a good point, Paul, that you said. And yeah, because obviously that would be the only imagery that we would understand at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Everything, as you say, your family were devout Roman Catholics, you went to a Roman Catholic school, you went to mass, you went to church, you did everything you were supposed to do. That was the cultural enrichment around you. Everything was focused on that, I would imagine, other than the times you were able to probably play out playing football or just running around on the streets with friends or riding your bikes or whatever. It would be that.
Yeah, I mean, even the other kids, you know, they were all, again, even now, some of them, you know, if I look back or look forward to say now, some of the people that are now adults, they're still following that faith, you know, the Catholicism. And, you know, again, they're again Irish families.
Yeah.
That are really, you know, strict Catholics, and their children follow that faith, and it will go on and on and on. But, you know, but that's all we had really. Everywhere you looked when I was growing up was Catholic families, and they all knew each other.
Yes.
So everyone knew everyone.
Yeah.
So if you've done anything wrong, you know your dad's going to know about it.
Yes.
You know, and I was more afraid of my dad than the local, you know, the sergeant.
Yeah.
You know, the police sergeant.
Yeah.
That walked around the roads, and even though back in them times they were, you know, they were strict, and you were frightened of them.
Hmm.
So nothing compared that to your dad.
Yeah. No, that's very true. The only time I was scared of our local Bobby, Michael, was when I was dating his daughter.
Yeah. All right, yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, anyway, moving on.
Yeah, as you do.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting aspects of these early experiences is I know you had these moments where you would get a feeling as though you were being summoned or called somewhere, Michael. There's one particular incident where you went up, you felt compelled to go upstairs and stand in a bedroom. There was nobody there.
No.
And then they appeared. Did that happen a lot? where you would get a feeling, or there was be some kind of anticipation, whether you, you know, the hairs would stand up on the back of your neck, or you'd feel anxious or whatever. Was this the usual precursor to an appearance, or was this just one of their specialities that on occasion you would have to go somewhere and then they'd appear?
I think it was as a child when I was having nose, I did have, it was like a feeling. Mm. That's the only way I can explain it. It was a feeling like you needed to go somewhere. So in that case, from what you spoke about, I was playing with my toy cars at the time. My mum was in the kitchen. Mm. And I just felt this overwhelming feeling that I should go upstairs because someone was coming and I needed to be there for them. And, you know, that's the only way I could articulate it. But you know, often was the time I went with how I felt, feelings. Mm. It's like following an energy, if you like.
Yeah.
And then I went up and I went into the room and there was no one there, but I had a feeling I should wait because they would be coming soon, whoever that was, and they did. They just appeared. Mm. But there have been other times when I did have these feelings, you know, when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, around, I would say more around the age of 15, 16, 17, I would have feelings to, you know, sometimes get up in the middle of the night, early hours in the morning, and go out. And just go somewhere, you know, within the school grounds, you know, when it's pitch black and, you know, but as I said in the book, I knew the grounds like the back of my hand.
Yeah.
I would often go there and a lot of the time I'd just look up at the sky, but I don't know why. It's just a feeling, you know, in a way you can't sort of reason it. It's, you're going with that feeling that it's almost like you have to. Mm. I know it sounds a bit silly, but that's all I can say. So it was a strong, overwhelming feeling. You had to, like, a lot of the time I did. If it wasn't outside and I was inside and it was the night time, I'd get up and I needed to go to a certain. And funny enough, one of the places that I used to go a lot of the time is where me and Sean first had our encounter.
Yeah.
So that was one area that I used to go to a lot, and I used to stand there looking up at the night sky. Mm. God knows why. But and obviously there was the other time in the book that I explain what happened with the Greys, you know, when I was in the living room. Mm. So that was another time when I had that feeling, well, don't go and sleep in your bed, go downstairs. I had that as well, which I will explain in book two. I had a lot of that where I had those feelings where I must be somewhere.
Yeah.
And then when I did, an abduction took place.
Ah. Which is unusual, really, because often when we hear about people who've had experiences or abductions, Michael, things usually come to them. It's not the other way around, Michael. I think you've got whatever's going on, you've got a bad deal going on, sir. They should be coming to you, Michael, whatever's happening here, I suggest.
I do have that as well. I have I have the experiences where I get them coming to me as well. Mm. Yeah. And again, you know, I'll explain more about that. In book two, I'll also speak about a friend of mine who, when I was living in Essex, he had a run-in with what was possibly one of the Greys who thought it was me.
Ah.
But that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I spoke to him about it the other day and he still remembers that.
Mm. At what point then, Michael, did the Nordics take a back seat and the Greys come forward? Were these visits running in parallel, or did it start with the Nordics and turn to the Greys and the Nordics stopped, or did you get both, or what? Was it a case of one started and then stopped and then something else came along, or were they both running together at the same time? Because I find that this bit I find really interesting, because whenever I've spoken to other experiences, it's all or nothing usually, Michael. Mm. There aren't many people that have two differing types of encounters with different entities, whatever they are. You're one of the few people I've ever read that has seen more than one, because often there is this happy clappy version of the Nordics, as I'm sure you've come across as you've done your research, that they're here to help and they're not doing how anybody knows that, I do not know. and the Greys are malicious and malevolent and up to no good. So did they both carry on, or did the Nordics stop and the Greys start? How did it work for you?
It's that the Nordics, you know, were there for a while with me. Mm-hmm. And I did see a male and a female, and then at other times I saw another male, but a different one. But the Nordics suddenly stopped coming. And then it was a little while after that that I started having these encounters with these type of creatures.
Mm.
And obviously, again, I had one with the MIB.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, as we say, Michael, neither of us have got the answers here. We're just throwing things out and seeing what sticks sometimes with this kind of conversation, I think. Have you ever thought why? Or, as we've been saying earlier on, is it a case of, are the Nordics really the Greys and that's just a front to sort of lull you into a false sense of security, and so the bothersome ones can turn up and stick their fingers in your mouth and just really annoy you and give you nosebleeds and things, as they're prone to do? Or do you just think that, I don't know, did the Nordics find everything they needed to do and then they've gone off and somebody else has gone, oh, well, it's our turn now, we'll come and bother him?
Yeah, you know, you do. You never stop wondering, really.
Mm.
It's always there, you know, it's going to stay with you. And it maybe you learn a few, you may learn something new about them, but then, you know, further up the line, that might be thrown out the window because something else comes along.
Yeah.
You know, that's often the case with research.
Yes.
You think you got something and then you haven't.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the phenomena is so difficult to, you know, pinpoint. It's so difficult to actually get something solid from it,
mm.
you know, because, you know, it's a bit like, you know, it goes up in a puff of smoke.
Yeah.
But it's difficult. You know, maybe I'll get the answers one day about who these Nordics were. I don't really, this is just my opinion, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think that the Nordics are, you know, so much here, you know, good.
Mm.
I don't have that type of thinking.
Mm.
But it's just my own opinion. I'm not trying to upset anyone else's thoughts on the matter. That's not my intention, you know.
Yeah.
But this is just purely my own thoughts from my own experiences, and obviously from, I guess, trying to understand it.
Mm. Yeah.
And trying to weigh it up and trying to go back in my mind from that time of my childhood, which, you know, like in the book, I'm quite detailed in my book because I can remember in exact detail as though it was yesterday.
Yeah.
But obviously there are elements within this type of phenomena and what I've had where my memories are fragmented. I just don't know.
Mm.
You know, there's certain, but I think that's more to do with, sometimes it's to do with, you know, I would say it's intentional from their point of view of hiding those memories from you, you know. Mm-hmm. And other times it's, you know, it's trauma.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a bit of both, but I do believe that they intentionally hide you know, this type of stuff from us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with screen memories.
Yeah, well, as with any aspect that someone suffers deep trauma or PTSD, Michael, the brain is a wonderful protector of us, and often our brain can lock things away for us to look after us, to make sure that we're not suffering too badly, regardless of anything else that's going on. So it could be an amalgamation of a couple of things going on, that you're trying to do a bit of self-care, because the brain is a wonderful thing. Even though you don't know what it's doing, it'll be saying, no, actually, we're just gonna move these memories out the way for a bit. Let you calm down and we'll just keep them there. Because it's weird how, even as adults, there are certain things like a piece of music or an aroma, Michael, or a visit somewhere can just take you flooding back 40 years. And it's almost as if somebody's just clicked their fingers and you're like, bang, I'm 10 again.
That's right. And well, this is very much the case with hypnosis, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, when people have hypnosis, they're recalling the memories by retrieving them from the subconscious mind.
Yeah.
You know, which is where normally they're hidden.
Mm.
Mm. And they're just below the surface of the conscious mind. So a lot of the time, I think when you have, you know, phobias, you know, especially with abduction stuff, it tends to be, I would say, an end result of those memories that you don't consciously remember, but they're playing out below the surface.
Mm. This encounter with the man in black, the first time this happens, was this, Michael, after you'd had a visitation from the Greys, or was this sort of you'd only been visited by the Nordics at this point? Because it's a very strange encounter, but this often happens when I hear about certain encounters, especially in the men in black, the women in black field, that there are very odd encounters in these. I mean, they're usually quite strange encounters anyway, but I always like the really weird ones where, for example, there's a very famous case in America where somebody turned up, typical man in black, and said, right, I need to speak to you for 45 minutes. And he sat this family down, started taking notes, and they were talking, and then he just got up and left. And they checked, and he'd been exactly 45 minutes. He just got up and went. You know, and other ones about somebody who was just constantly drinking water, like far more than somebody should. One of my favourite ones is the one where the guy seemed to break down and had to be escorted out, and he couldn't understand what a table was. He couldn't work how to get past it.
No.
And so, I mean, you're just having a normal day at home, isn't it? In the evening, even. And then all of a sudden you spot this character staring at you as though he's trying to evaluate you for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, this happened after the encounter with the tall white grey. That's right, with me and Sean. Mm. So it happened, I would have to say it happened after that, not long after that. And on this particular occasion, obviously, again, I didn't know who the hell he was.
Yeah.
But he looked solid to me, not a ghost or anything like that. And again, we didn't have anything to, anything that was familiar in that way, not even, you know, from the TV.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have there weren't no posters up or anything from anything like that. There's no way of... Yeah, it was just odd. And also there was only one of them at the time. Normally they're together, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's normally more than one. Mm. But, you know, whether there was another one, as I said in the book, whether there was another one around is speculation, really. I don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, rather than say, yeah, you know, there was, I don't know. But there may have been. Mm. I can't say for 100% that there was.
Mm.
I've only wrote about what I experienced, and that's what I experienced.
Mm. I think it shows as well. I know you were saying about how you consider the possibilities of your parents knowing a lot more about what was going on than they ever said to you.
Yeah.
Because I'm struck by the amount of times that you tell your parents something's happening, and they go and look for you. You know, like we said, I found it quite funny that this particular incident, your dad went in, checked the house, the door was still bolted. So he couldn't have gone in a particular way. And they went, well, he must have crawled out the kitchen window. And you think, well, he could have. But that's a bit... How does he get in? That's it's these things that you look back at. At the time, it's a plausible explanation. But then you look back at it and you think, that doesn't make sense.
I think it's because, you know, I don't know. I can't say for sure if my parents, you know... I know my parents did have experiences, but again, they didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a bit odd in that way.
Mm.
They never used to speak about anything like that, you know.
Mm.
Every now and again they used to. My dad used to tell me things every now and again, you know. Yeah. But you know, he wasn't somebody who was prone to fantasy.
Mm. Mm.
You know, he was I think back then he wasn't.
Yeah, and typical no nonsense working class man of the era.
Yeah, he was he was a working class man, but he was really hard working, and he was he was a person that he didn't tolerate nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it also shows that they must have put some faith in you, Michael, because, you know, with the greatest respect, I'm sure we all know there are parents, if a child said something like that to them, they'd just say, shut up, stop talking rubbish. They wouldn't go and check the house for them, Michael.
No.
So,
as I said in the book, you know, I was often afraid of my dad.
Yeah.
But it was just, I guess, Irish, you know, and very, very strict, that's
yes.
all.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, and I would imagine he was brought up that way.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And you know, and it was par for the course everywhere in those days, Michael. It's not a unique thing. Your dad wasn't doing anything that nobody else was doing. You know, I used to, you know, I remember growing up and some of my friends would hate exam result day because they knew they were going to get a beating when they got home. So,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's 40 years ago. It seems like a million years ago when we talk about the world we live in these days. But my goodness, people soon forget these strange things. So I found that these aspects of it quite interesting about all that. And I know we've just touched on it there without really diving into it. So you and your brother, Sean, a couple of years older than you, there are two particular incidents in the book that you refer to. The first one is Sean seeing some kind of saucer in the sky, and then the second one is this strange entity that's encountered in the school.
That's right, yeah.
How far apart were these two incidents then? Because I know, as you've just said there, the man in black incident certainly happened after the creature that that was seen in the hall happened. So was the saucer first, then the entity sighting, then the man in black?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, in that order.
Mm-hmm. So this saucer encounter is one of those typical ones that seems to happen all over the world, that you have people just doing normal things. I think you were mucking about playing football, weren't you? And then suddenly Sean spots something odd in the sky.
That's right, yeah. It was a silver metallic object. Obviously, it was quite bright because it was reflecting the sunlight, I would guess.
Mm.
But yeah, we were playing football just on the green, just outside really, where the schoolhouse is.
Mm.
So it's on an embankment, and then we went off to have a walk around, and it was then in the location of the infants' classes and the school hall and library where Sean saw this object, which we know now as a daylight disc.
Yeah.
Typical flying saucer. But for me, it's not so much the oddity of seeing it, it's the oddity of having, no one else seeing it.
Yeah.
Because it's in the busy London, in the area of London where we were, it was very busy. You know, we had lots of warehouses that were open, going about the businesses and,
yeah.
I was at the back of, one of the largest police stations in London at the time, which is still there and still in use today by the firearms squad. But how this craft was able to come so close to us, and yet maybe people did see it, and maybe they've not spoken about it. I don't know, but that for me is quite odd. It's quite an odd thing, really.
Mm.
And you do often get that, don't you?
Yes, you do.
Sorry, yeah, you do often get that.
I think it's one of those things. You hear this quite a lot with people, and they have an encounter or they have a sighting, Michael. And one of the first things they think is, this has got to be on the news. Everybody must be able to see this.
Mm.
And yet,
exactly.
They check the papers, they put the news on, nothing, not a thing.
No, there's nothing there. I mean, I've had this before as well, where I've seen something bigger than what I saw then, but and nothing's ever reported. It's not in the papers. I see saying when I was in Essex, and when I did, there was about 40 other witnesses to this, and even the police knew about it.
Yeah.
And I reported it. I reported it to an official website for ufology, nothing. If it's not mentioned, this is the only one that wasn't mentioned on their website, and no one spoke about it. It wasn't in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw was so big, traveling around in the night sky, seen by over 40 witnesses. Police were informed. There was a police officer who I was going. I was going to see a friend at the time, but there was a police officer in this particular road that I was good friends with, and I don't know if he knew, but his station was called, so he might have known then, by one of the eyewitnesses, but nothing was ever said of it. There's nothing. I was expecting to see it in the newspapers, but nothing.
Mm.
And that's quite odd in itself, which makes you wonder, did we just see it and no one else did?
Yeah, yeah.
Because this, this is something that Jenny Randalls talks about in the Oz Factor.
Yeah.
Some people are, and I mentioned that in my book because she kindly allowed me to use that.
Yeah.
In the book, which was really nice of her.
Mm-hmm.
But she explains it quite well, doesn't she? Mm-hmm. That some people can see it whilst other people are outside of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that applies to certain aspects of it. I've always wondered about paranormal events where people are on trips or tours of places, Michael, and there'll be a party of people wandering about, and a couple of them will see something odd and nobody else in the party will see them, even if this person walks through the crowd or is stood in a position where everybody must be able to see them, and yet do people see them out of 30 or whatever? It's a strange thing, and I know Jenny obviously coined the term the Oz Factor about 40 years ago, I would think it's probably early 80s. So it's an interesting aspect that it's that strange. It's almost as if you're in some kind of bubble, Michael, and everything around you stops. The noises stop. It goes dead silent. I've spoke to people where they've had encounters where it's been a windy day. The wind drops instantly. the trees aren't blowing anymore, or birds stop chirping, or the traffic just seems to melt away, the noise of traffic, which for anybody who lives in London is usually a blessed relief, Michael, but it's also a sign that something's seriously wrong. If the you can't hear traffic at any time in London, there's a problem.
Exactly.
So it's one of those frustrations, and I would imagine, like you say, this is probably the catalyst for you to begin to think that these can't be normal things, because people should be able to see them. Obviously, the sighting yourself and Sean had with the disc, and then that led on to this freaky creature being discovered. So was this in the same school that you guys went to that your dad was the caretaker of?
Yeah, he was the, as I said in the book, he was the caretaker before in the old school, which wasn't far away. It was in Chamber Street,
yeah,
which was far from this school. But when this school was built, he then moved. So at that time, he didn't have a house with the job. So when this school was built, I suppose it was just natural that he went to become the schoolkeeper here, but with a house this time in the grounds of the school. Yeah. It was me and Sean that went to this school. We, as I said, we had two brothers that are a lot older than us.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to the old school in Chamber Street at the time, and then they went off to, they attended different secondary schools. Me and Sean went to the same secondary school as well,
yeah,
which was a strict Roman Catholic boys' school this time.
Yeah.
And, I do mention that briefly somewhere in the book. We went to the same school, yeah, this school. And this is where in this particular book, this activity was either into the school house, my childhood home, or it was in the grounds of the school, or it was in the school. So it's very much centered around this particular location itself.
Yeah.
Rather than anywhere else. It just seemed to be centered around, this particular location. So when we saw this particular creature in the school, it was in there. It was in the summer holidays, in fact.
Yeah. Which is, I suppose, as well, is a strange aspect then, because As an adult, Michael, and as you refer to in the book, you lost contact with your brother for quite a while. So
yeah,
it would be interesting to consider if you were both living parallel experiences, but due to not being in contact for that period, you weren't aware of each other's incidents or whatever. I mean, did Sean's continue? Because I find it peculiar, not in a negative sense, Michael, I find it peculiar that the majority of occurrences happen to you, and yet we often hear that only as we've just been pondering about why only particular people can see certain things, and is it this odds factor that allows specific people to see specific things? And yet whatever was going on would occasionally let its guard down so Sean could witness it as well.
Well, Sean, from what I, before I was born, I was told afterwards that Sean, that there was an unusual thing that happened to Sean, where he went missing from a busy beach.
Huh?
When my parents were there, and family, and there's lots of other people, and he suddenly vanished, and there was actually, he couldn't be found. He was gone for hours and hours, and the police were involved and they were looking for him and they couldn't find him nowhere. And then suddenly he appeared and he was just there, literally where they'd searched. And no one knew where he went. And no one knew how he got back. So, this was something that happened to him. And I don't know. This is what I've been told anyway. And, that's the only thing I can say from the earlier, years, what happened to him. But, I've often wondered if it continued with him. But the thing is, though, Sean's not a sensitive person in any way, shape or form. He's the total opposite to me.
Yes.
I'm empathic. I can feel things and understand energy in that way. Obviously, I have lots of paranormal experiences and spiritual type experiences. But Sean's not really like that. He's quite closed off from that. But the question is, was he like that? And did he close off afterwards? Aspect of it. When he was younger, maybe he was sensitive to these things, but maybe, again, as I say, maybe he, from the experiences he was having, like me, And he had some with me, but it's possible, I don't know, that he could have gone on to having other experiences that we just didn't know about.
What? So this incident with this creature then.
Yeah.
How the ramifications, because once again, this is one of the, as we say, that throughout the book, there is this strange theme of you and Sean, or mostly you, having these weird encounters, mentioning it to either your mum or your dad. And yet here you are, you're just having a mucking about school holidays, hanging around.
Yep.
It's the old school babysitting, take your kids to work. Keep an eye on him most of the time, I suspect. Keep him out of trouble. So what happened? How did Sean find himself in this situation?
Well, we were in the situation together, but we my dad had, it had been the summer holidays, and, you know, during the summer holidays, the cleaners come into the school. So my dad obviously is in charge of them, and they're cleaning bits and pieces of the school. You know, they got 6 weeks to clean it, I guess. And, you know, when they went home, Dad went back home to have a bite to eat. And so, you know, that gave me and Sean the opportunity. There was no one else in the school. Go over into the school, into the main school. We went up in through the big brown doors, up the staircase. And inside where we were, it was the inside toilets, you know, girls and boys toilets. And we decided to play a game, you know, hide and seek. And, you know, Sean was counting, and I went off and hid into an area, there was an area in between the toilets where I could hide. And then when he was counting, he stopped around five, you know, at five, and then it went all quiet. And at the time, I wasn't sure if he's tricking me to see, you know, to jump out on me if I come out. And I did come out, and then he was standing close to where the secretary's office was. Mm-hmm. And just in front of him, just to the side of him, was the library, the school library. But just when he was just standing there looking through there was two brown doors, and another set of two brown doors that led into the gymnastic equipment was. And then when I looked to see what he was looking at, that I could see that there was this odd looking creature standing right next to the piano or anything. And it was just like really odd. It was really tall. And it had a spindly body, long arms, and what would be classic, you know, what would be like a classical grey, but taller, with big black eyes. And so at that time, you know, we were both at the time, I guess, paralysed. We couldn't move. That, you know, again, that could be to do with fear. Mm. And we're just staring at this creature, and it was staring at us. But it just felt like, again, like we lost time. Time had vanished. We'd gone into an altered state of consciousness, I guess. And then it was gone. But then when it was gone, you know, it's almost like when I was in the room and these Nordics suddenly vanished, and, you know, I'm running from that location, but I don't know why there was terror there. And this is what happened with me and Sean. So there's like an area of our minds, what's missing, a memory of what happened in between that time. And so we're running away, and we're, you know, crashing through these big brown doors, swing doors, with the wide glass, ready to go and get our dad. And he's already coming up the stairs because he's finished his break.
Yeah.
So then when Sean, you know, Sean's the first one to say to him that, you know, there's somebody in the school, Dad, you know, and, it, you know, added it's not human. And he's like looking on our faces to see if we're just, you know, messing around with him. And obviously he can see that we got fear in our eyes and, you know, shaking. And so he goes to look. I guess he's looking for a human, yeah. Obviously. You know, he wasn't sure what to make of it. And so he went off and looked. But again, he come back and just said, you know, there was no one there. There was no windows broken, no windows open. The doors on the inside were locked. So there's no way that anyone could have got in or got out without either opening the window, breaking it, or opening up the bolts on the door. And from in the where he was looking, he looked quite a few places, I guess, but couldn't find anyone. And he just sent us back, you know, to go and play, but stay close to the house. And that was that. But, you know, later on, we you know, from what we understand, it was spoken about in the family.
Yeah.
So it's odd, you know.
Well, I think, because I don't want to spoil this book for people, Michael. I don't want to dive too much into stuff. I want people to buy it because it's a very powerful and compelling series of articles and incidents that you've collated here. But there is one last thing I want to touch on, because I have to say, Michael, when I got this book and I started reading it, the one thing I did not expect to find inside the cover was the chapter about Spring-Heeled Jack.
I thought you were going to say that.
Now, primarily because I'm interested in exactly what you saw, but
right.
After that is obviously some of the information that you've had supplied to you by the researcher MJ Wayland, who's obviously someone
yes.
who's kindly allowed you to use something, which features one of the strangest cases I'm aware of from my local area, because I live in Sheffield.
Right, okay.
And I will get to it once you tell me about what you saw, Michael, and then I can explain why this particular chapter has hit me so hard, because I've got something that might interest you to add to what you've got included in this particular chapter.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm. So it's 1976. You have one of these weird feelings.
The feeling is, it's like you're being watched. So, you know, sometimes you get these feelings that are often, you know, yeah. associated with this type of phenomena, whether it's the paranormal or, you know, aliens or lights in the sky. There's often the feeling that you've been watched.
Yeah.
And it's possible that you are being watched, or maybe it's possible that you're just picking up on something.
Mm.
Yeah, but on this particular night, so we were having a bath, you know, at the house, and I'd got out of the bath, and, you know, Sean was going to get in the bath next. And I went into my parents' room and, you know, wrapped myself in a towel, and I was near the windows.
Mm.
The light was on, obviously, and we had, like, white net curtains over the windows. But it just felt like when I was there, it felt like I was being watched and from the outside, you know. But when I pulled the curtain up to look, it was dark outside, and just opposite the house was the garage, the top of the garage, you know, the garage and the roof.
Yeah.
You could see on top of the roof.
Hmm.
And then when you looked out from where the windows is, you got the, what would be, class 4 and 5, you know, for the upper years.
Yes.
And it was there that I saw this strange creature almost like crouched down on the top of the roof. If that makes sense. And
yeah.
And suddenly, it leaped from, you know, quite a long way from that roof, which was quite, you know, quite high up, basically upon to the garage roof, you know, and it done it quite, you know, as I said in the book, quite effortlessly. It didn't hurt itself. It just come down.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, again, what the odd things are is that why didn't I call for my dad?
Yeah.
Because he wasn't very far away. He was like literally in the, you know, on the left side of the room,
mm-hmm.
where the bathroom was. When I saw this creature, I didn't know what it was. And again, as I explained in the book, I don't know if it was there or if it was somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, as I said, like breaking through the fabric of time, you know, was it in another dimension? But I could see that dimension, you know. I don't know. I'm not sure. But all I can say is that when I saw it, you know, it looked like it had a cape on it.
Yeah.
But at some point, obviously, that changed when later on, I'll tell you. But at the time, it looked like it had a cloak around it, around its shoulders, you know, long black cloak.
Yeah.
And it basically it allowed me to see it for some reason. And I'm not sure why that was. I'd never encountered anything like that before.
Yeah.
And it had like fiery red eyes.
Yeah.
And it had like claws on its hands.
Mm.
Quite long, you know, claw like. And I've had this again, but not with them, but with the greys.
Yeah. Like talons. Claw
like hands. Exactly like that. And I had that with the greys a few times as well, where I've actually touched their hands, which was an odd experience.
Yes.
but this thing, when it was there, it allowed me to see it, and I was literally looked at it in its eyes, and it looked at me. There was no communication whatsoever.
Mm.
But when it did, you know, it was only there for, I would say, for, you know, a few minutes.
Yeah.
But then when it got up from its position, it was like in a kneeling position or crouched down.
Yeah.
But then when it stood up, I could see it lifted its arms up, and it had wings on it.
Mm.
So what I thought was a cape initially wasn't. It was some type of wing.
Yeah.
And then when it leapt up again and it jumped onto the building, which was a warehouse,
yeah,
on the opposite side of this road, which was, as I said in the book, St. Mark Street.
Mm.
and it went up there, and again it crouched down and it was watching me, and then it gone. Mm-hmm. It didn't disappear, it moved off, you know, like when you turn around and go off.
Yeah,
that's what it did. But so then I at the time I didn't know what it was. It was only years later that I come into, you know, I saw the stories, and that this particular creature, whatever it was, terrorized the Victorian London.
Yeah.
And it was very similar in appearance. You know, I've often wondered over the years if it was, you know, the one in London, if this particular character was somebody using technology, somebody who's probably, you know, quite wealthy, quite well educated. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, again, it's only a theory. Mm-hmm. Or if it was from the other stories, if it was something interdimensional.
Yeah.
Which it clearly had, you know, when you look at some of the stories of it clearly had that there was something quite you know, supernatural about it.
Yes.
It was in 1837, I said, in Victorian, yeah, England. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it? And yeah, and then a little later on, it was he was at one time, it was believed he was the Jack the Ripper.
Yes. Yeah, I think somebody wrote a letter claiming to be Spring Hill Jack, didn't they?
That's right. Yeah. So but I've not, you know, no, after seeing this particular figure, creature, I never had it again.
Yeah.
There is a character that I did have later on, but there's somebody, you know, I speak about later on, but I've not done much research on this particular character, but he has been seen, you know, in various places in the United States, in Pennsylvania and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, it made me raise my eyebrows, because as I was reading that particular chapter, you obviously mentioned MJ Weyland talking about the strange incidents in Attercliffe in Sheffield.
Yeah, yeah.
Michael, now, without diving into that again, 20 years ago, I went back to college as a mature student, did my A-levels.
Right.
And as part of our sort of weekly registration class, where we all sort of chewed over the week and what we were doing and separate courses and whatever, as part of that, at the end of the year, we had to give a talk to the rest of the group about a particular subject. I've always been interested in these wonderful subjects, but it's only sort of the last 5 years since I've started doing the show that I just don't care what anybody thinks anymore. I'll talk about these all day, and if they don't like it, hard lines. So
fair enough.
I had to do a talk, and I discovered this article and these reports that MJ Weyland mentions to you in the book. Right. So I thought, brilliant, I've never heard of this happening in Sheffield. This is, like I say, it's 2002 it was when I gave this talk, Michael. So we all had to choose the subjects, and I said, oh, what are you going to do? I said, oh, I'm going to do strange stories of Sheffield. And they said, all right, yeah. So I had to do this 20-minute talk. So I thought, this one's brilliant because it's just so weird. So I read the reports out, and obviously quite similar to the information that you've got from MJ in your book. And I read it all out, and all of a sudden, and I noticed one of the ladies who was in the class was crying.
All right.
Michael. And I thought, this talk isn't that bad, you know?
No.
And I did it all. Everybody went, yeah, brilliant, that's really good. Anyway, it was finished up. She came over to me, and she said, oh, Paul. I said, what, why were you so upset? She says, can I talk to you outside? I said, yeah, of course you can. So we went outside, and she said, I saw that. I said, you what? She said, yeah, I saw that. And I said, what do you mean? And she lived in Attercliffe when this was all going off.
Oh, blimey.
And she was upstairs in an attic bedroom with her sister and her best friend at the time. She was 10. And they were sat there watching telly on a portable black and white television. And they heard a funny noise on the roof, like somebody tapping on the roof. And as they looked up, they'd got one of those skylights, like a Velux window. You know, the ones that open in, and you pop it and it drops either up or down, depending on how the roof works.
Sure, yeah.
And as they looked up, this head with glowing, blazing red eyes, Michael, was staring at them, tapping the glass with claws.
Wow.
And she said, they all screamed. Everybody in the house went into bedlam. Parents came running upstairs, wherever. Dad goes running on the street, calls the police out. They go, can't find anything. She said, I've thought about this for 25 years, Paul. I've never heard anybody talk about it again. And I just wanted to let you know, I know that happened because I saw it myself.
Wow, it's amazing.
So it just shows you, you put the right person in and give them the right information, you never know who's going to come forward. It's always astounded me because she was a very normal person. She had normal interests, you know. I wasn't overly weird back then, Michael. People weren't, you know, I'd mention it in passing about I was interested in these strange subjects and things.
Nothing been wrong with being weird,
oh,
is there?
Yeah. Oh, no, I fully embrace it now. I wear my badge on my sleeve and my heart these days.
There'd be weird people at my parties every time.
Absolutely.
If you're not weird, you don't get in.
If you're not weird, your name's not down. It's simple as that. But it just shows you that unless somebody knows that somebody else is aware of what's happened, she's clearly never spoken about that, because it obviously had such an impact on her that it made her cry. And she cried because she was so relieved that somebody else had seen it.
Well, this is what's important. I mean, if you hadn't spoke about that, she would never have mentioned it.
No.
And it would probably remained with her until she died.
Mm, absolutely.
And with this particular experience that I had with this particular creature, I've never really spoken about that to anyone. It's just one of those that you don't speak about.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I suppose maybe it's because it's, in a way, it's a little bit more stranger than strange.
Yes.
There probably is a lot more information out there on this particular character, and a lot more people that have seen him, but have just not come forward. You know, they may read about him, but they may not want to share it with anyone because it's, you know what I often think though, and I say this to some people sometimes, is that, you know, when you ever say, if you've got a group of people and they're talking about the paranormal and then they're talking about abduction or something like that, and I've encountered this, is that when they're talking about it or when they're reading about it, that's fine. It could be, you know, it might be true, you know, but then when they come into contact with somebody who's actually having those experiences, it scares the hell out of them.
Yeah.
And they don't want to know you. You know, I've often had people, you know, being afraid of me because of having these experiences. You know the reason why? Because they think it's going to happen to them.
Yes.
And it's not going to happen to them because the abduction programs happen when you're a child. They happen when you're an adult, but the adult is often the child, and the child then becomes the adult. With the greys, they have a particular type of program, and the program is targeting children. It targets the children, and then that child then is the same, is the adult. But people do, they get it in their head, you know, oh, you're an abductee, you know, if you happen to say, you know, stay at my house.
Yeah.
This might happen to me.
Yes.
It won't happen to them. I mean, they might see something, but then it's not often that they're taken.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's always better to tell them those kind of stories after they've slept there, Michael.
Yeah.
Tell them over breakfast, my friend.
Tell them over breakfast.
It is something I've encountered. In my social circle, you know, I've had friends who have told me they've seen ghosts and strange things.
Yeah.
I've never had a friend talk to me about an abduction experience. However, I have got to know somebody recently who has come to me and said that it's happened to me. And I think it's primarily because they listen to this show, Michael.
Yeah.
That they know they can talk to me and I will treat them honestly and seriously. I won't laugh at them. But it's very interesting that I've come across that kind of, well, if I know about this and I knock about with this person, I'm going to get taken as well. And I don't know where that's come from. Is it a presumption? Is it something that's been on a program or a film where people happen like that? But for me, I felt very honoured that this person felt comfortable enough with me, from somebody he's only said hello to in the street and things, Michael, to then come forward and say to me, this has happened to me all my life, and I'm desperate to get a chance to have a sit down with him and a cup of tea and have a real chat with him because I'm really interested. I'm not frightened.
No.
I'm interested, and I'm also humbled that he thinks enough of me through listening to this show that he's comfortable opening up and being honest with it. Because I would imagine, such as yourself and other people that I've spoken to over the years and other people I've got to know since doing this show who have not appeared on this show, that the biggest problem everybody has that's had these experiences is being able to unburden themselves knowing that they are not going to be laughed at, Michael.
Yeah, because you know it makes you you're very vulnerable.
Yes.
With these type of encounters and whatever they may be. I mean, I've wrote this book, and when you're writing the book and you're putting all that information in there about your experiences, you're still vulnerable then, because you know at one time you might be only telling one or two people, but then you're opening yourself up.
The whole world can see you now, Michael.
Exactly like that. But it's when you've got people like yourself, Paul, and you know, you've got Paul Sinclair, and you know, you've got the Philip and Ronald,
yep,
and their podcasts, and you know, people are listening in, or they're reading, you know, their books, and it does, it reaches other people. It may reach people that are frightened to talk about it.
Mm.
But when they see people that are writing the books that have had the same experiences as themselves, mm, it may help them to come forward, knowing, like you said, that they're not going to be laughed at, ridiculed, or made to feel stupid, or they're fantasizing, or they're liars.
Mm.
And that's a good thing, because
yes,
when you have this and you're on your own with it, it can be quite dangerous.
Yeah, of course it can. Of course it can.
Because you have nowhere to go with it. I mean, I've had this all my life.
Mm.
You know, you don't have nowhere to go with it. And as I said, you know, sometimes when it's those closest to you that are laughing at you or ridicule you, the knife cuts deeper.
Yes.
You know, then when it's a stranger, it hurts. But when it's somebody that you think, you know, maybe a little bit more understanding, don't necessarily have to believe you,
mm,
but be a little bit more considerate,
mm,
and you know, when you're getting the piss basically taken out of you,
yes,
even though those people have had similar in some ways experiences than you,
mm,
but they choose to shut them off, but then they choose to ridicule you.
Yeah,
it's quite you know, it's hurtful.
Yeah,
and but you don't know, it is you know, growing up and that and having these experiences back in those times,
mm,
there was nowhere to go with it.
Yeah.
You know, I could either go to the church or I could go to my doctor, as yeah, I said in the book. And yeah, look what happened there.
Exactly. They both went well for you.
Yeah, they went well for me. I mean, I didn't even tell him about the abduction.
Yeah.
God knows what would have happened then. I would have been chucked in this padded cell.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey. Well.
Yeah. Throw away the key whilst he drinks his whiskey.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. Well, Michael, it's a compelling book. I can't wait for the second volume to find out what on earth happens after this. But I just want to say thank you very much for writing it. Thank you very much for joining me today. It's
thank you, Paul.
It's powerful. It's surprisingly moving in places, and it also makes me chuckle a little bit in some places. It's a bit of everything, and I look forward to the forthcoming volumes. Where can everybody follow it, buy a copy of it, Michael, and keep up to date with what you've got coming up next, sir?
Well, it's on Amazon. It's on the paperback hardcover. It's on Kindle. I think it's on Kindle Unlimited as well. It's just come out on audiobook. And at the moment, as a new author, I'm creating an author's page where people can go when it's put it up at some point,
mm-hmm,
but where they can go to find out other information. And obviously, if there's anybody out there that wants to contact me about anything in the book, or they just, like yourself, Paul, want to talk, they can.
Lovely.
So at the moment I'm working on a book two,
mm-hmm,
which will be volume two, the follow on to this. And I'm brainstorming a book three, which is it's the same type of subjects, but it won't be in the series of this.
Right.
There will be a book three, a volume three to it. Mm. But book three that I'm doing is separate from these. But it is, again, to do with this type of phenomena.
Mm. Mm. Brilliant. Well, thank you, Michael, for your time, your conversation and your candid honesty. It's been lovely to speak with you and sharing some of these experiences and memories with us. I'm always humbled when I speak to people such as yourself who are happy enough and honest enough to come on here and speak and talk about these things. I always like to think that I'm open-minded enough to allow people to relax and know that I'm not going to ridicule anybody or make light of their experiences. And I just want to say thank you again for sharing it. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Michael, and I look forward to our next conversation down the line.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I've really enjoyed it, and thank you for putting me at ease and allowing me to answer your questions as best I could.